If they did a sequel to The Graduate, we'd probably find that Ben didn't get a whole lot farther than what we saw in the original. Like most of the few that make the transition, he would probably treat his new state as a destination rather than a departure point and be quickly repatriated with the herd. Never fully, but fully enough. That's what I'm trying to help Lisa get beyond. Ben's transition was relatively mild. He was still just a young sapling, his roots shallow and sparse and easily yanked from the ground. At 21, he had no family but parents, no kids, no mortgage and debt, no friends or extended family, no established career, none of the many complex roles he would have played had he been more established, more deeply rooted in his life. In short, he had his breakdown at the ideal time, when there was very little to cut away from, very few people to betray, very little to lose. But what happens when the same crisis occurs 20 years later, when the root system runs far deeper, when it's much stronger and much more intertwined with surrounding root systems? Then, instead of The Graduate, we'd be watching The Partner. At 41, Ben is no longer a sapling that can be easily ripped from the ground. Now he's a tree. And that same single step of progress at this more advanced stage of emotional arborization requires a tremendously greater amount of explosive energy and a far more powerful source of discontent to fuel such an explosion. It's not tidy or surgical or contained. It's not spiritual or compassionate or blissful. It's going to make a huge mess. It's going to do damage to all surrounding and intertwined growth. If Ben had continued on his trajectory for another 2 decades before his epiphany occurred, then instead of just rebelling against tragically unhip parents, he'd be cutting ties with wife and children, with friends and extended family, with work and community and church. His career and finances would be reduced to a shambles. Everything he'd worked so hard his entire life to build would be smashed to rubble. And all for what? You don't ride away from that in the back of a bus, grinning like you beat the house and stole the life-sized trophy. Who's the hero in The Partner? Who's the good guy? How do we see an older Ben in that situation except as a psycho-spiritual terrorist? A guy who infiltrates people's lives and, when he gets in nice and deep, goes off like a bomb. A mole under such deep cover that he doesn't know it himself until the wake-up call comes and triggers his detonation. Who's he sitting with in the bus at the end of that movie? What would he have to smile about then? If the movie The Graduate continued for another 15 minutes, we'd see where Ben and Elaine were really headed. They've smashed heroically out of the prison cell of parental constraint, and now we'd see them crawling through the sewer pipes on their way to where? They have to find a place to settle, to be. They have to find another cell to crawl into. First, they would go to a seedy motel. Then Ben would have to go out and buy Elaine some cheap street clothes. Then what? Ben has to get a job. They have to crawl back to their betrayed parents for their belongings and for help. Elaine gets a job or gets pregnant. 20 years later, Ben and Elaine would be playing house, dealing with their own rebellious kids and bitter parents and jobs and bills and a crumbling marriage. Everything they thought they were breaking out of when they were only digging deeper in. No one lives happily ever after. What happens when that same awakening comes late in life? For that, we are fortunate to have the film About Schmidt. Warren Schmidt's Color by Numbers life was in perfect order. He did everything right. Then it all comes undone as every layer of his carefully constructed identity is stripped away until even Ndugu, a starving Tanzanian child he sponsors and writes to, looks upon Schmidt as an object of pity. One by one, all his emotional attachments and layers of selfhood dissolve. Job, wife, home, friendship, family, alma mater, history, future, options, and with no happy ending tagged on because the clock has run out. The film ends honestly, with a man who played by the rules and did everything right, sitting alone, weeping. Dear Ndugu, relatively soon I will die, maybe in 20 years, maybe tomorrow. It doesn't matter. Once I am dead and everyone who knew me dies too, it will be as though I never existed. What difference has my life made to anyone? None that I can think of. None at all. Warren Schmidt. That's a great realization for young Benjamin Braddock, a cataclysmic one for 30-something Lisa, and a very sad one for old Warren Schmidt. Lisa had a much rougher go of it than Ben Braddock. What for a 20-year-old kid is like plucking a daisy is, for her, like dynamiting a well-established tree from the ground. Not pretty, but effective. She was very fortunate to find so much unhappiness in her life for those 3 years, which is something she's starting to understand now. She killed her parents, which is just another way of describing the transition from childhood to adulthood. There are no books in the self-help or parenting or New Age aisles called Kill Your Parents or Never Grow Up. But there should be such a book. And in a world where the inhabitants weren't all developmentally arrested, it would be handed to every child by their adult parents at the age of 10 or 12. But then again, in such a world, there'd be no need. After Lisa tells me about Dennis, I tell her my thoughts about The Graduate, The Partner, and about Schmidt, and use them to help her understand the developmental status of her husband, of Brett, of herself, and of virtually everyone she knows. We talk about vertical versus horizontal progress and the critical importance of the word further. We discuss some other movies as we cross the state, seeing how old stories function as new stories. She asks if there has ever been someone like me in a movie she might have seen, an awakened being. The Razor's Edge, she suggests. No, I say, that's about you, not me. Larry is going through this same transition to adulthood you're going through. Instead of a picture of a woman falling to her death, he had the war and the memory of a dead friend. The dead look so terribly dead when they're dead, he says. He's going through this process of self-birth, exiting one life and entering a new one. In the end, he has broken with all aspects of his former life, even cutting himself off from his own family money, as I recall, and starting a new life in New York as a humble taxi mechanic. But he doesn't end up enlightened? No, He ends up where you are now, at the beginning of his life. And if he's perceptive, he'll be thankful for all the forces that conspired on his behalf to get him there. Death, war, murder, blessings disguised as tragedies. You should read the book and see how it compares to your own experiences. You'll find some very interesting parallels. So you think there was a real guy? Had to be. It's too accurate. His initial break, his confused searching, his pattern and stages of progress, his final vanity, the way the universe facilitates his journey. Mom couldn't have made it up. So Larry only did what I did? There's no only about it, kiddo. Where you are now is where all the great sages and wise men and seers and mystics are. They're just a little further along. I could be one of them? She asks. A mystic? Or a sage or something? They're just roles. You can play whatever role you have an authentic desire to play. The recognized and respected wise folk are seldom very advanced in their development. You can go beyond them. You'll see. She seems pleased and says nothing for a few minutes. Then, what would be a movie about someone like you? She asks. I think about it. The character of Tech Support in Vanilla Sky is a close representation of me in my role as teacher. Someone who explains the option of either staying in the dream state or jumping off a high-rise roof to awaken from it, and waiting patiently, available but disinterested, while his client struggles with the decision to wake up or stay asleep. But that's just a minor character I play in other people's dramas. Cast away, I say after a few moments. Really? Tom Hanks? On the island? I don't get it. She pauses. This isn't going to make me sad, is it? Maybe. I don't know. I'm feeling a bit raw today, I guess. You're saying the Tom Hanks character became enlightened through his experiences on the island? No. He just found himself thrust into the unadorned paradigm of the awakened being. Being alone on a desert island is a good metaphor for the awakened state. By getting stranded on that island, he has effectively died to his life, but without physically dying. Prior to the crash, the Tom Hanks character, Chuck Nolan, had everything we think of as a life. Friends, career, family, fiancé, as well as the countless other big and little things we take for granted until they're gone. It's all about context. Chuck Nolan, at the beginning of the movie, has a full, rich context. He fits in his world. He has a robust belief set. He is a part of things, and things are a part of him. And then, bam, his plane crashes, and it's all gone. Suddenly, simple survival is his only context. What does that leave? A man without a context. A man who is, in all respects, except physically, dead. A man with 24 hours a day with nothing to do but sleep, eat, and stare at the waves. The differences between him and the man he buries and eulogizes with such zen-like succinctness are negligible. And that's what it's like to be enlightened? That's what the truth-realized state is, the absence of context. There's no artificial framework in which to say one thing is better or worse than another. He had his friend, she says. Wilson, the volleyball. I guess he had to go a little soft in the head to make that relationship work. Actually, that's a relationship I can understand. Yes, he had to go a little soft in the head to make it work. He had to bend, or else he'd break. He had to play a life-or-death game of make-believe. He had to believe the untrue and disbelieve the true. He had to perform an act of Orwellian doublethink. The power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. Chuck Nolan knows Wilson is just a volleyball, but he must believe Wilson is a fellow being because he cannot not have a fellow being in his life. Wilson provides the context Chuck can't live without. Without Wilson, Chuck will snap. But with Wilson, Chuck can bend. Before the plane crash, Chuck's context was reflected back to him by virtually everyone and everything in his very meaning-rich and clock-centric environment. After the plane crash, all that's gone, and there's just one thing left to reflect it. A volleyball with a bloody handprint that kind of looks like a face. It's not much, but it's all he needs to pretend he's not completely alone on an island in the middle of nowhere. That's what context is, and that's what it does. It tells us that we're not completely alone on an island in the middle of nowhere. It provides the illusion of a populated environment in which meaning and values can be perceived and applied, where it matters what we do and what choices we make. All context is artificial. There is no true context. Castaway, reduced to its allegorical structure and stripped of everything after Chuck's rescue, provides us with a powerful vehicle of philosophical inquiry. Chuck Nolan had his attachments severed, but he never wanted that. He's been forcibly liberated from a prison where he was perfectly content. Someone slipped the red pill into his drink, and he woke up outside a matrix he never knew he was in. All he wants is to get back in, but he can't. He's locked out of his own life, not really dead and not really alive. Who wants to be cast permanently adrift on a shoreless sea? Who wants to spend the rest of their life tumbling through infinite space? No one, of course. What's the point of pointlessness? How can you want nothing? Words ascribed to the Buddha are often fraudulent, but there's one very clear exception, and it's the quotation at the beginning of this book. Truly, I have attained nothing from total enlightenment. That statement is like an optical illusion. It can be viewed two ways, the less obvious one, the more correct. It's not so much that he didn't gain anything as that he did gain nothing. I see, says Lisa after we've discussed it for a while, but she doesn't. She doesn't see that what Chuck does to survive is what everyone does to survive. She doesn't see that she herself is alone on an island in the middle of nowhere, that she's gone a little soft in the head, and that her mind has reshaped itself to fit her needs, that her life is given shape and form and meaning only by her capacity for doublethink. She doesn't see that Chuck Nolan's soft-in-the-head relationship with a volleyball wasn't unique, that it's the same tactic employed by all people, all the time, in order to maintain the state of denial necessary to continue a meaningless existence in a fictional universe. But Lisa is feeling a bit raw today, so I don't bother her with all that. Writing the books has provided me with an artificial context within which there are things to do and reasons to do them, within which one thing can be better or worse than another. Once the book project is over, once I'm done scribbling words in the sand, then I'll turn around and face my desolate island of near total contextlessness. Really, for the first time. It's been nice to have something to do and a context within which to do it. When the teaching and writing thing is over, and I've moved into the new house with my new dog, my last remaining layers of artificial context will have vanished. If I want them after that, I'll have to generate them, if I can. I pondered this in the first book. Idly, soggily, I wonder what comes after. The island is what comes after, as I've always known. A secluded oasis, devoid of contrivance and fabrication. Chuck Nolan didn't like his exile. He didn't want it, and he spent his time on the island wanting to get off and get back to his former world. That's a significant difference between his condition and the awakened state. I can't return to the world from which I am self-exiled, and I have no such desire. Maybe I'll continue with this curious act of writing words in the sand since I'm in the habit, but probably not as part of any agreement with the universe. So it will be a different sort of enterprise, a hobby, not a vocation. My dog will be my Wilson, and I'll have to go a little soft in the head to make it work. I have no problem with that. Chapter 28. Live Free or Die. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asked.
"Where do you want to go?"
responded the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered.
"Then," said the cat, "it doesn't matter."
Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland. I pace back and forth in the sand where I've paced back and forth on a dozen previous visits, like I've paced back and forth in front of many other groups on many other nights. The difference this time is that this will be my last time. Lisa is seated with Dr. Kim in the front row, and another 70 or 80 people are seated in the sand and in the bleachers. They all appear interested to hear what I have to say. So am I. My threefold task, the way I see it, is to eulogize Brett while saying what these assembled people most need to hear in a way that best serves the book. I have a piece of paper with some quotations in my back pocket, but I haven't given much thought to what I'll be saying beyond that. Everyone was told to bring $20 each tonight to go towards a memorial gift to be presented to Brett's daughter, Melissa, later in the evening. Some of them paid more, and Dr. Kim would later make a generous contribution. The gift itself will be a surprise to the group, but not to Melissa, who has known about it for several months, since the beginning of the planning for tonight. The gift was in the hotel safe, waiting for me, as hoped, and now sits in my pocket. "We're going to sit in here and listen to me for a few minutes," I tell them, when they've settled down. "Then I'm going to leave you in the hands of my designated guest speaker, Lisa. Later on, we're all going down to the lake, where we'll have a fire and say a proper goodbye to our, let's say, friend. To our friend, Brett. I don't know how we're all going to squeeze in down there, but these things have a way of working out. When we go down there, we'll hook up with Brett's daughter, and maybe her granddaughter, and will have a little surprise that might knock your socks off. A gift for them that you've contributed to. Anyone have any questions at this point? Some do, and we end up killing half an hour with casual conversation that serves to get everyone settled and comfortable. It's a beautiful early autumn evening. The lights are on low, and there's a misty rain falling that creates a soft patter on the aluminum roof and lends a coziness to the riding arena. Tonight's activities will actually run, off and on, for more than 4 hours. After a period of pretty relaxed discussion, I start veering into the reason we're all here. I'm told the last time you all came here and met with Brett was about a year ago. Who was here for that? About 20 hands go up. What happened? What did she say? Nicole? Nicole is a professional woman about Lisa's age who worked with Lisa and Dr. Kim to organize tonight's meeting. Well, you know how she was. Pretty loud. Always cussing and getting in our faces. Yes, I reply, and everyone laughs at the memory of the fiery Brett. Well, she wasn't like that. It was the only time I ever saw her kind of as herself. She was very soft-spoken, not so much accent. She was very polite and a little sad. She just sat down with us and explained that the meetings weren't doing what she thought they would, that she felt like she was acting more as an enabler of our denial rather than an agent for positive change. She said maybe that was what we really wanted, but she didn't want to serve that purpose. It was pretty sad. Some of us were crying. I nod and pace back and forth in front of the bleachers and nod some more. How do we manage not to find the one thing that can never be lost? How do we manage not to see the only thing there is to be seen? Why do people who say they want to see refuse to open their eyes? These are the questions that must have been tormenting Brett. This is what she couldn't understand as she looked back at these eager, alert, intelligent faces from where I'm standing now. How do these people, who say they want to escape from delusion, manage only to dig themselves deeper in? And how have I, someone who knows where they want to go, and how to get there, been turned into just another sleep aid? Brett couldn't answer these questions, so she shut it down. That's very understandable to me. What's not so understandable is why she opened it up in the first place. Dr. Kim is the answer, I suspect. Now these friends and students and admirers of Brett want to know something about her, something she didn't share. They want to know why she terminated this thing they had together. They want to know why, before she died, she turned her back on them. I start talking. I start delivering my final lesson, Brett's eulogy. Why are you here? I ask the group in a rhetorical sermon-like tone. What do you want? I hold out my hands as if to receive an answer, but none is forthcoming. I said right at the beginning of the first book, Damnedest, that you have to know what you want. You have to have a clear desire, a strong and specific intent. If you don't know where you're going, then there's no basis for judging one direction better or worse than another. I don't want to single anyone out, so just let me ask. Can any of you stand up right now and say, in a few words, what it is you want. Why you came here to see Brett.
No one stands up.
I keep pacing and let the silence hang there so everyone can grasp its meaning. No one knows what they want.
How would you have answered that question? One of the guys, Ronald, asks.
I stop pacing. I face the group squarely and answer.
It's not how I would have, I answer. It's how I did. I said that I want to stop being a lie. I want to stop not knowing who and what and where I am. I want to stop being confused and unclear. I want to stop pretending lies are true and that I understand things when I don't. I want to stop playing make-believe and find out what's real. I will give anything to do it. I will cut off my hands or pluck out my eyes or chop off my head. Nothing is too much, and no price is too high because a life of ignorance and self-deceit has no value to me. There is nothing I won't do or give because I would rather be dead than continue in this blighted, benighted condition. I set no terms or conditions. I relinquish all opinions and preferences. I just want to know what's true. Whatever it is, come what may. They stare back at me in silence. Live free or die, I say. That's the motto of escape. It's just that simple. I repeat the one simple question none of them have an answer for. What do you want? Why are you here? They continue to stare. Ronald stands up. I think we're all intelligent people, he asserts, feeling some need to mount a defense. I guess you don't seem to think so. I wonder if he got uppity like that with Brett. No matter. I like uppity. Not true, I say. I know we're all intelligent people, but intelligence is a curious thing in the dream state. Can't live with it, can't live without it. It's like an ice pick in a balloon store. We have to push it into a cork or things are going to start popping. That's the real point of all spirituality and religion and philosophy. They are the safe corks into which we can bury the sharp points of our mind. This self-inflicted dulling of the wit is how we constantly cast our own sleep spell. No one else is doing it to us. There is no magic behind our delusion, except the magic we conjure with our own emotional energy. If we stop weaving our enchantment, we start waking up. And that is the last thing we want to happen, even though it may be our stated intent. Whatever we might say, we don't want things to start popping. I pause. I pace. I ponder. If I talk about food poisoning or stomach flu, does everyone know what I mean from personal experience? This is met with a chorus of groans, which I interpret as a yes. What? I ask in mock display. No one likes violent stomach flu? Cramps? Nausea? Vomiting? No? Diarrhea? Fever? Chills? Nobody? Jeez, tough crowd. Curled up on the bathroom floor all night? Your body racked and heaving? No one? Wait a second, I haven't told you the good part. How about a violent stomach flu that lasts for a year and a half, maybe 2 years? Any takers? Nope. Come on,
Seriously, what would it take? I prod them. What would make 2 years of violent stomach flu worthwhile for you? What would make that worth enduring? What would make you want it? I pass my gaze over the entire group. $1 million? An extra 20 years of life? The return of a loved one who died? They sit in motionless silence. Oh, wait. I've got it. How about nothing? Anyone? 2 years of gut-wrenching purging for absolutely nothing. The line forms to the left. Who's first? They're unsure as to how amused they should be. Am I being funny or gratuitously gross? Am I dishonoring Brett's memory, or am I making a valid point? I think they're giving me the benefit of the doubt because they're used to Brett's wild, off-color orations. Brett could be an earthy woman. Stay with me, please, I say. This analogy is tight. Violent stomach flu is very much the physical counterpart of a spiritual awakening process, and it's one of those great metaphors that just gets better the more you play with it. I see how you're all looking at me, like even if it's a good metaphor, that doesn't mean you want to hear about it, especially when we're all here to commemorate Brett. Trust me, this is about Brett, and it's about all of you. It's about why she had these meetings and why she decided to stop having them. They settle into a more attentive mood. The main feature of both of these processes, spiritual awakening and physical stomach flu, is the violent and indiscriminate evacuation of all contents. Physical in one case, mental and emotional in the other. By indiscriminate, I mean no picking and choosing. If it can go, it does go. Upheaval, downheaval, every which way heaval, emergency purge, blow all tanks. I'm aware that this is all just talk to them. They haven't gone through this process I'm describing, and I doubt any of them will in this life. But this is my last time addressing a group, and it's a great analogy, and I'm not going to let it, go to waste. Both processes come in waves, I continue, cycles of agony and relief. You finish one bout of violent retching, and for a little while you feel okay. You think maybe it's over, but then it starts again. You feel that first twinge of not rightness, that first subtle rumbling that tells you all is not well, and you know what you're in for, and there's nothing you can do but write it out. It builds from bad to worse to unbearable, and then explodes out in all directions, leaving you weak and trembling, unable to endure anymore. Then there's that brief period of respite, and the glimmer of hope that it's finally over. Then you feel that twinge, and the whole cycle starts again. On and on it goes, wave after wave, far past the point where you're sure there's nothing else to come out. But there is. I pace back and forth and study their faces. Didn't your other spiritual teachers explain about this part? The year or two of gut-wrenching expurgation? No response. I spend the next few minutes pacing back and forth and pronouncing the names of a few dozen well-known spiritual teachers, gurus, and authors, living and dead, with a pause after each in case anyone wants to raise a hand and vouch for any of them, and so they can take note of the fact that no one does. I end the last with a single name. Brett? All hands go up. I really wanted to be clear about that. Now we can continue. Something else that's important to appreciate about this analogy, I say, is that when you have the stomach flu or food poisoning, it seems like your system is going totally haywire. But it's not. There's an intelligence at work. It's a process. The organism is putting itself through this terrible ordeal for a reason. These same things can be said about the awakening process. It looks like total mental and emotional chaos. But it's a process, and there's an intelligence at work. The process works a certain way, and there are reasons for it. And now for the cherry. And the analogy is still incomplete, I say. I've said many times that no one really wants what this really is. The prize at the end of this 2-year bout of violent illness isn't just nothing. It's nothingness. That's what it means to say that it's not just something we don't want. It's something we can't want. There's no it. No one looks in the least bit happy. How would someone make it happen if they wanted to? Asks Nicole. How would someone induce this process? Excellent question, I reply. Very close to the heart of the matter. Can you make it happen? What can you do? You can't just take an emetic like some spiritual ipecac to induce the vomiting of a lifetime. You can't just shove your mudra-shaped fingers down your throat. You could try sitting in zazen for a few years, try to puke up that ball of molten lead they talk about. Let me know how that works out for you. To really make something happen, you have to become poisoned. You have to introduce some foreign agent into your system that's going to grow and spread like it has a life of its own. Maybe this foreign agent is already inside each of us. Maybe it's that little voice that urges us to come to meetings like this, some seed of discontent, and it just needs to be nurtured and encouraged. Maybe this foreign agent is the only thing in us that isn't foreign. I observe my thoughts to see where this goes next. Can you make it happen? I ask. Can you keep it from happening? I have no idea. My opinion is that it's not within your direct control. You have to pray for it and use spiritual autolysis to bring your desire and intent into sharp focus to find out what this little voice has to say, and if you want to hear it. But what we keep coming back to is that if you don't want it, you don't want it. That brings us to the question at the very center of this entire subject. Why? Why make yourself want something you don't want? Why try to initiate a 2-year bout of violent illness for nothing? That's a tough one, because there is no sane reason to do it. You have to become insane. You have to go out of your mind. What it takes to get out of Maya's funhouse is so extreme and so counter-instinctual, so unwantable, that it can't happen within the mindset we think of as sanity. These books would never be complete if I didn't get this said. Within the context of living a long and happy life full of people and diversions, being stuck in a jail cell or a wheelchair or a hospital bed or an unresponsive body might seem like the very definition of hell. But that's a factor of the context, not the circumstances. Do I mean to say that terminal illness and physical disability and institutional incarceration are just minor nuisances? I mean exactly that. Within the context of growth, progress, development, motion, realization, liberation. The tables are turned, and the physically constrained might actually enjoy a considerable advantage over the freely mobile. Focus, intent, vision, will, heart, clarity, maturity, seriousness, warrior spirit. That's what's needed. Not the ability to run out to the market when we want a snack. We may not be able to change our circumstances, but we can change our context. A prison cell can be a zendo. From a wheelchair, we can fight a war. If we are physically restricted, there may be many things we can't do. But if we can still possess the sword of mind and the heart of will, there is still one thing we can do. And within the context of this book, of these three books, it's the only thing worth doing. The only thing. This isn't physical warfare. It's spiritual warfare. And to fight it, you need spirit, not arms and legs, or a rosy future, or wide open spaces. I can't pretend to understand the plight of someone who is addicted to crack, or sentenced to life imprisonment, or confined to a hospice, or an asylum, or a wheelchair. But I can, with certainty and conviction, say this. In my own process, my own struggle and journey of awakening, of dying to the false and being born to the new, no physical encumbrance would have been any match for my will, and may, if anything, have proven quite advantageous. The very idea that my physical circumstances would have prevented my awakening, so long as my mental and emotional resources were reasonably intact, is, to my certain knowledge, absurd. To further support this point, I repeat the words of Melville Ahab that I included in Incorrect. What I've dared, I've willed, and what I've willed, I'll do. They think me mad, but I'm demoniac. I am madness maddened. That wild madness that's only calm to comprehend itself. The prophecy was that I should be dismembered, and I lost this leg. I now prophesy that I will dismember my dismemberer. Swerve me? The path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails, whereupon my soul is grooved to run. Over unsounded gorges, through the rifled hearts of mountains, under torrents' beds, unerringly I rush. Knots an obstacle, knots an angle to the iron way. What Brett did, I continue, was instead of finding a way out of life, she found a way in. Like a judo master, she turned this father demon's energy to her own advantage. She figured she was finished anyway, between the progressing cancer and this father presence poisoning her existence. So she realized she had nothing to lose. If I might digress for a moment, I'd like to say that I have nothing but good things to say about this particular realization. Nothing to lose. It's perfectly true of everyone, all the time. But it's the realizing part that's tricky. Once you get to that realization, though, not just conceptually, but fully absorbed throughout your awareness, then this whole thing just bursts wide open. Walls come down, and the universe opens up. Anyway, where was I? Who asked if there was a way to put a demon to good use? Shanti? She nods. Well, That's exactly what Brett did. As she explained it to me, everything was just coming apart. She had the cancer with gloomy prospects, and she still had this dumb father thing yapping in her head, blaming her for everything, blaming her for being sick. She sought help. She looked to religion and the self-help aisles of bookstores. But no matter what she did, no matter where she turned, no matter what book she read or what method or ideology she tried to embrace, there was still this voice in her head telling her that it was all just nonsense, that she was too scared to face facts, that she wasn't brave, that she was being an idiot, a fool, all sort of nasty, negative things, on and on like that. And all the while, she's just getting sicker, and her time is getting shorter. Then one day, her search for answers and meaning having yielded no fruit, she realized that this voice in her head might not be totally wrong. It was very cynical and abrasive, but not necessarily incorrect. The more her illness drove her to seek answers, the more she found herself agreeing with her father's voice. All the answers she was finding were nonsense. When it came to her search for answers, for meaning, for ways to cope with her disease and her mortality, this cynical voice in her head was saying things she not only couldn't deny, but with which she agreed. I wish she were here to explain this to you the way she explained it to me. But the main thrust is that this is how she processed herself into the truth-realized state. Instead of working through it with a tool like spiritual autolysis, she did it with the aid of this built-in, hypersensitive bullshit detector that had been plaguing her for so many years. She was operating under what she believed to be a sentence of imminent death. She thought she was in her final months, and she was intent on getting to the bottom of things, finding the meaning in things. She wanted to find something real, something true. I take a break to drink some water and let that last bit settle in. A bunch of private conversations spring up, but everyone quiets down when I return to center front. Why should such extreme measures be necessary? Why should we have to go through such an agonizing ordeal just to become who and what we really are? I don't expect an answer. I turn it up a notch. Flow and obstruction, I say, are the basic operating principles of life in the dream state. For most people, though, it's all obstruction and no flow. They say we are spiritual beings having a human experience, but really, we are mortally constipated spiritual beings having a subhuman experience. The pandemics of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and cancer that ravage the Western world are merely the outer manifestations of a far progressed inner condition. While only some of us are physically fat and diseased, virtually all of us are spiritually fat and diseased. Morbid spiritual obesity is a plague that has decimated the human race, leaving this lovely planet little more than a terminal care facility in which we sit glassy-eyed and slack-jawed, whiling away the hours of lives we didn't ask for and don't know what to do with. A world of moribund hospice patients mainlining on flavored morphine and running out the clock. That leaves a few moments of silence in its wake. But maybe that's all that people want to do, suggests an older fellow named Henry, rushing to smear some lipstick on this pig, to be spiritual couch potatoes, go to work, raise their families, zone out in front of the TV or whatever, It's not hell. It's just life. I agree. No one is kicking down doors and dragging people out of their beds. You all came here to see Brett. She didn't seek you out and lure you in, did she? You came to her asking for this, right? Henry nods in agreement, as do others. Did Brett ever talk about how great enlightenment was? How it would solve all your problems, fill you with love and peace and happiness, elevate your soul, let you transcend the human plane and even death, give you special powers? Anything enticing like that? No one responds. This is another important thing to make clear. Did she ever try to talk you into anything? Did she try to convince you of anything except to think for yourselves, to look and see for yourselves? Was she like some glad-handing salesman or baby-kissing politician, making promises about how much better life would be if you bought into her special brand of spirituality? Was she running some sort of get-bliss-quick scheme? Did she espouse any teaching? Did she irradiate you with her Shakti energy? There's a bit of laughter because everything I'm saying is so obviously un-Brett. I wait and let the questions hang for a moment. I don't want anyone thinking we're here tonight to say goodbye to some beloved prison trustee, just another of Maya's legion of flunkies and toadies, a cheerleader for a message of niceness and passivity and contentment, a hypnagogue. Hypnagogue is defined as an agent that induces sleep. Maya has unleashed an army of hypnagogues into the world to induce and maintain the sleep state. All well and good. I have no issue with that. I just don't want people here tonight to think that's what Brett was. Most of you know that I have a pretty strong contempt for the spiritual marketplace, a pornographic mockery of man's desire to know the truth, I think I called it. Do you all understand who and what I meant by that? Nods and grunts of general assent. Do any of you think that applies to Brett? Was she someone who was pushing an agenda, trying to get rich, building an organization, publishing a newsletter or a blog, going on tour? Did she want to be popular? Did she need her self-image as a spiritually superior being reflected back to her? Did she ever even smile? Christ, was she ever even nice? They are alert and attentive. They know something important is being said, something near the scary edge of things. Did she ever ask for money? Try to sell you anything? Invite you on a cruise or a coastal retreat? Did she ever dress up or adopt a title or a spiritual name? Did she ever claim a teaching or lineage? Did she ever utter a Sanskrit or Japanese term? At the meetings, did she turn down the lights, play music, light candles, begin with a prayer or meditation? Anything like that? The only response is some gentle laughter. This is an important point to make, like listing all the teachers and authors. We have a very nice show planned for this evening, but none of it means anything if these people come away from it lumping Brett in with the world of spiritual whoredom. Brett was the real deal, I say. And that's such a rare thing that it's very easy for us not to know it when we see it. That fiery temperament you saw wasn't her. That quiet, thoughtful person some of you saw in that last meeting was closer to how she was away from all this. This is a very challenging message to deliver, and she became the person she had to be to get it across. She stopped the meetings when she realized the truth of what I told her every time we talked. That there's a total disconnect in this teacher-student relationship. A total disconnect. We don't have what you want, and you don't want what we have. Brett didn't want to believe that, but finally she couldn't help but see it was true, and that's when she stopped having the meetings. I have other reasons for doing this teaching thing, but she didn't. So now, with the help of the Dalai Lama, I'll answer this question I've been asking. The question is, why are you here? What do you want? I take a piece of paper from my back pocket and unfold it and read one of the quotations I scribbled down. "In the final analysis," said the Dalai Lama, "the hope of every person is simply peace of mind." I refold the paper and put it away. Does anyone disagree? No one does. Me neither, I say. What do you want? Peace of mind. It's that simple. So you came here seeking this peace of mind from Brett. But she thought you were here for the exact opposite. She was a disruptor, an agitator, a metaphysical anarchist. She was all about smashing things up and burning them down. She was an iconoclast, a revolutionary. She thought you wanted war, and the whole time you wanted peace. I agree with the Dalai Lama. Peace of mind, spiritual consonance, is what virtually all seekers of all places and all times are really seeking. It all makes perfect sense when you look at it that way. Why is everyone seeking and no one finding? Because they're not seeking truth or growth or change. They're seeking peace of mind. The rest is just dressing. What's so bad about peace of mind? Asks Justin. Nothing's wrong with it, I answer. It just doesn't register with someone like Brett. Or like you, he says. Or like me. Right. Personally, I think about this idea of peace of mind, and I shudder in revulsion. To me, it's just a fancy way of saying that people just want to keep munching their cud and plodding along, head down, surrounded by herd mates, unconscious, unengaged, unalive. To someone like me or Brett, peace of mind is the enemy. It's the worst thing in the world. It's the cow. It's the inmate. It's the hairless, fetal thing that's still plugged into the matrix. I mean, peace of mind. I make a gun of my finger and blow my brains out. What's the point? That seems to get them a little agitated. Don't be insulted by any of this. It's certainly not your fault. This is the universal seeker dynamic. You can go to practically any spiritual teacher or clergy member, and they'll help you in your search for peace of mind. Brett was the one who didn't get it. It's not just that she didn't know you wanted peace of mind. It's that she would have found such a desire incomprehensible. Even if you guys had said it straight out, it wouldn't have computed for her. She would have equated peace of mind with being asleep. So it would be like you were coming to her and asking her to put you to sleep. That's the disconnect. Just as it doesn't make sense to you that we think you come here to have your lives incinerated, it doesn't make sense to us that you come here asking for sleep. I signal a break, and everyone gets up and stretches. After 15 minutes, we all return to our places and speak casually back and forth for a few minutes. After a while, I introduce a reluctant Lisa. She comes out, holding her day planner. She is visibly uncomfortable and embarrassed. She doesn't really understand that she, a spiritual neophyte, has succeeded where legions of spiritual veterans have failed. She agreed to speak. I didn't try to convince her. She understood what I was trying to show her, that she still had a big thing to do, and she decided she wanted to do it, and that standing in front of these people and telling her story might help her do it. She opens her day planner to a photo and hands it to someone in the front row to be passed around. She has a hard story to tell. She starts slowly, in the clipped fashion of a painful, emotional confession, but then, eyes down, voice soft and wavering, she finds a quiet, heartfelt rhythm of expression, and the story begins to flow. I step out so my presence won't make things harder for her. 20 minutes later, from out in an adjacent field, I hear loud and sustained applause, and I know she did good. Brett and I never got any damn applause.